Case number 11-3029, United States of America v. Eric Maurice Brody, appellant. Ms. Wright for the appellant, Ms. Barr for the appellee. May it please the court.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Lisa Wright representing Mr. Eric Brody. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The marshals here subjected Mr. Brody to an illegal seizure of his person, and the evidence discovered thereafter was, in the words of Wong Sung, come at by exploitation of that illegality such that suppression of all evidence is required. First, the seizure here was straightforward. The marshals ordered Mr. Brody to put his hands on the car, and he submitted to that show of authority by putting his hands on the car. His decision thereafter not to submit to a frisk and to end the seizure by taking his hands off the car and leaving does not alter the fact that he was seized within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment.
And how do you distinguish U.S. v. Washington, which the government relies on?
We think Washington is different in the being in that a car is quite different because with the situation with a car, it's ambiguous. Really, what the siren signaling someone when they signal them to stop is not just to pull the car over, but to submit to an encounter. And that did not happen in Washington. Here, there was an encounter. He was ordered to submit to it, and it happened. In Washington, in cases like that, the defendant is actually, it's sort of a trickery where the defendant is lulling the police, and actually, he's not submitting, he's aiding his escape. He's helping himself flee by pretending to submit, but then he never does get to the point where there is an actual encounter. Here, Mr. Brody did do exactly what the officers asked him to do and actually was in the pat-down position. And he is submitted was the pat-down was beginning as he fled. So that's very different than sort of partially acting like you're going to submit. The officer in Washington was clearly
well,
not
there
just...
there wasn't any evasion in Washington up till that point, was there? I mean, he did stop. He was ordered to stop.
The police officer
turned on the siren. He stopped the car.
Right.
Isn't that equivalent to putting this, in our case, putting your hands on the roof of a car in terms
of
submission?
I think not, because I think we all know when a siren goes off, the officer isn't just saying, I want you to pull over. He's saying, I want you to pull over and wait for me to come talk to you.
I see.
And that's not what happened in Washington. And in fact, it gave him the upper hand in the encounter. Not only did he not submit to it, he actually increased his position vis-a-vis the officer and enabled, you know, facilitated his escape. So there was a seizure, and the government has the burden of justifying the seizure. And they point to Michigan v. Summers, which allows the detention of occupants of premises being searched under a search warrant. But even assuming the government has met the burden of showing that Mr. Brody was an occupant, which I'll get to later, of the target house, the intervening decision in Bailey by the Supreme Court makes clear that there are strict spatial and temporal proximity limits on Summers detentions that cannot be met here. Summers applies only to occupants who are present when and where the search is being executed. And here, Mr. Brody was not present when, or detention did not take place when or where the search was being executed. It wasn't when the search was being executed because it had not happened yet. The marshals were waiting out of sight around the corner for the search team to arrive when they rounded the corner and approached him before the execution of the warrant.
So under your theory, we don't even have to look at the other factors for determining immediate vicinity?
That's right, because it was not temporally proximate.
Uh-huh.
And we would compare this court's Reed case, for example, where the police were past the man with the battering ram in hand and were about to batter the door down when the man came out. This was a situation where there was, you know, really pre-search surveillance, and then they opted to go jump the gun and go over there. Even then, the search wasn't beginning. They just went to identify and pre-search. And as far as the...
If that's the right reading of Bailey, it means that the officers have to either abort the search or proceed under circumstances where there's a distinct risk that the person will, in fact, alert people in the building or will, in fact, approach the officers from the rear. Isn't that true?
Well, from the rear would mean by that point they were executing the search. I think if they are executing the search...
No, he walks away.
Mm-hmm.
He knows something is about to happen there. If it's a proper inference that his coming out from the house suggests he's in cahoots with the people who were in the house, that means that he poses a distinct risk to the officers, right?
Well, I just think there has to be some limit to when you can say that someone coming out of the house, I mean, what if it's hours before or, you know, it's a slippery slope. The Supreme Court has said it must be when and where. Otherwise, there's almost no limit.
Suppose it were shown that the things the officers found to make the search, what they were waiting for was about to happen, and in fact, coordination of the search was a complicated problem.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
Suppose it were shown that organizing for the search was A, complicated problem, and B, the things which caused the delay of the search were about to be resolved, so that, let's assume that within 10 seconds the search would have gone forward.
Well, I don't know, there is no evidence of that here, but I just think there has to be, I think that's the whole point of Bailey when you read it, is that, you know, we have to set a strict limit, and Justice Scalia says you have to take the bitter with the sweet, and that if you're going to have this categorical rule, then you have to comply with it. There has to be a limit, otherwise they'd just be stretched. There'd be no, I don't see any other line, 10 seconds or you know, 3 days, really, before a search warrant's executed. They could just set up surveillance and say, we're here to secure the house for the warrant and then stop everyone that comes or goes, and that can't be right. I would say Bailey's pretty explicit about that. As far as the where, the government acknowledges that he was halfway down the block by the time they got to him, and he would have been even further if they hadn't jumped the gun and gone raced over there to...
Well, under your theory, doesn't the when take care of the case? Isn't that...
Doesn't the when take
care? The when, yeah. In other words, your point is there wasn't a search going on.
Correct.
Does it make any difference under your theory where he was?
No, it does not. I mean, we win
even... So even if he had been on the front steps, wouldn't it make a difference under your theory?
I think that's correct, because they went over there before there was a search underway. The search was not being executed, and Bailey says that it's you have to be in the temporal and spatial proximity of the execution of the search.
I ask because if the search was going on, it seems to me you have a pretty hard case to make in terms of the where side of the test, because he was just right there. He was not very far from the house.
Yeah, I mean, if the search was going on...
I mean, if immediate vicinity means anything, it certainly means where he was.
Yeah, I mean, I think if the search had been going on, it wouldn't have happened this way. He wouldn't have been down the block, because they would have stopped him like they stopped Reed as he was coming out. Uh-huh. See what I mean?
Right.
It's because it wasn't going on temporally that they didn't get there when he was still there.
Right.
They kind of raced over there and tried to create a summer situation, but they did not succeed. And Bailey says that the scope must be confined to the underlying justification where someone poses a real threat, and it's kind of hard to see a real threat here when they are waiting around the corner, and then they go and approach the house, not vice versa. And even if the stop does meet the spatial or temporal limits of Bailey, I mean spatial and temporal limits of Bailey, a remand, we would say, is required on the question of whether the defendant was even an occupant, because there was this factual dispute about whether he was seen leaving the house, and Mr. Brody attempted to put on the testimony of Officer Butler to say that the two marshals had told him that did not say that he had left the house, but that he was standing out on the driveway when they arrived. And that testimony, hearsay, is allowed at a suppression hearing. Just as the government used Officer Butler's testimony at the preliminary hearing for its truth, so Mr. Brody should have been permitted to use Butler's testimony for its truth at the suppression hearing. And there were multiple versions put forward of what the situation was when they arrived. Was he actually in the house, or was he not in the house? Was he walking away, or was he standing there? And there's no reason for the court can't assume that the district court would have found that he was an occupant if he had allowed Butler to testify. So the seizure is illegal for all those reasons. A remand at least is required, and the court must suppress all the fruit thereof unless the government can meet the burden of showing an independent act sufficiently attenuating the causal chain to dissipate the taint. Here, the defendant submitted to an illegal pat-down position. Rather than have the guns discovered via an illegal frisk, he gave the guns up right then, no temporal gap. The fact that he tried to get away while doing so was not an independent act that broke the causal chain. And for that, we rely on the Fourth Circuit decision in Wilson, which we think is right on point, and the district court decision from this jurisdiction in Roman Jones. In both cases, defendants were illegally seized. They abandoned, after the seizure, the seizure stops when they flee, abandoned contraband, and then the subsequent contraband was held to be the fruit of that seizure, illegal seizure, and we think that's exactly the case here. If there are no questions about the, or further questions about that,
You left it unclear as to what you're seeking. Are you seeking a reversal?
We're seeking a suppression of all the evidence, and in the alternative, a remand on the question of for us to be allowed to put on Officer Butler and any other evidence that flows from that. You know, we don't know what's going to happen on a remand. If there's no questions about the ACCA issue, we would ask the court to accept the government's concession that Mr. Brody's 15-year sentence is actually an illegal sentence and remand for resentencing no greater than the statutory maximum of 10 years.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Rowe.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Margaret Barr on behalf of the United States. Good morning. The district court properly denied appellant's motion to suppress evidence because, as the court found, appellant never actually submitted, thus there was no stop. A brief gesture of apparent compliance that lasts mere seconds, followed by immediate flight, does not indicate actual submission. The trial...
There seem to be two cases, both named U.S. versus Brown, from other circuits, where almost the exact scenario of this case proceeds. Both circuits, third and fourth, hold that to be a seizure. So the person is ordered to put his hands up on the car, he puts his hands up on the car, and then he takes off.
I don't think either Brown really involves flight. And then this circuit, you have a brief act of compliance and then flight. And this circuit found in Washington, and this circuit found that there was no actual submission.
But what do you make of Ms. Wright's distinction of Washington? As she points out, the court there said the defendant initially stopped, but drove off quickly before the officer even reached the car. And her point is that there you didn't have the police officer. It would be comparable to this case if Officer Clark were, you know, down 30, 40 feet away and had told him to put his hands on the car, but hadn't yet gotten there. Whereas here, you know, Clark was eyeball to eyeball with him across the hood of the car. Whereas in Washington, the police officer hadn't yet reached the car. Isn't that a pretty significant distinction in terms of the concept of submission?
I don't think it is really a meaningful distinction, and I think the appellant really tries to distinguish Washington based on there was some inference of trickery involved.
No, that's not the question I asked you.
Right.
I asked you the question about the fact that, I mean, the court doesn't say very much in U.S. v. Washington, but it does say that. Obviously the court thought it was significant that the officers had not yet arrived at the car, and therefore there had been no submission. And here the comparable thing is the officers had arrived at the car. In fact, it was a car.
Right. And the officer, Marshall Clark.
My question is, why isn't that a significant distinction when one thinks about what the heart of the issue here is, namely submission?
I think that is certainly a factor to be considered. I think duration is more of a key factor, and that is how long that the apparent compliance lasts. But Marshall Clark's testimony was that he was about 5 feet away from appellant, and then when he turned to give instruction to his partner, that's when appellant took the opportunity to flee. And in that sense, you have the same kind of flavor of Washington. You have the same sense of trickery. In Washington, there's no fact
in
Washington.
No, there was nothing in the, I didn't see anything in Washington about trickery. That was true in Baldwin, but not in Washington.
It's the juxtaposition of that brief compliance and then flight that gave rise to the inference that there was no actual submission.
Okay, so in your view, what would he have had to do here to submit? Suppose he had stood there for, suppose the record made it clear that he stood there for 10 seconds and then fled. Would that be enough?
Well, duration's a key factor, and also
what about 10 seconds?
Well, I think during that 10 seconds, there might have been more interaction between the officer and, or the marshal and appellant. And the key is he fled. He engaged in headlong flight.
That's my question. Suppose he had stood there for 2 minutes and then fled. Is the fleeing what's significant to you? If you'd been there for 2 minutes and fled, you wouldn't argue, right, that that was not sufficient?
Well, I think in 2 minutes, at that point, you would think a reasonable marshal would have in some way applied physical force to the appellant. But even if this court finds there was some sort of brief submission, appellant expressly acknowledges that any stop was cut off when Mr. Brody fled. And there's no fruit of the poisonous tree there. Nothing.
Not enough. I mean, if the seizure hadn't occurred, Brody would have been down the road and off to a happy life.
Well, the Supreme Court rejects that but-for causality test. And the test is that the evidence has to be discovered during the seizure or a lead has to be discovered during the seizure that's then exploited. And there's neither of that here. And Mr. Brody put himself in the exact position that Hodari D. was in. If this is Hodari, setting aside the legal basis that the marshals had under Summers, this case is Hodari with a stutter. He stops for a second and then he runs, and imposing a rule where all of a sudden he's insulated.
The district court said it was a matter of seconds. And the statement of facts in the case says that, quote, he stood there. Right? A statement of facts the government agreed to.
In the plea. But
well,
it doesn't.
That's the record we have before us.
But I don't think that changed the duration. The factual finding by the court is still that it occurred within seconds. So whether he stood there.
Well, within seconds could be 10 seconds. We just don't know, do we?
Well, the totality of the circumstances and the flavor of the case is that it was very quick. And the judge made a finding several times throughout his findings. He says there was no real stop. There was no real apprehension. Page 75 of the motion.
Well, but that's the district court's conclusions from looking at we're looking at the same facts.
Right, but that the government would submit that's a factual finding whether there is actual submission. And that's created by the inference that there was no actual submission is created by the fact.
So what do you think the government, what do you think the defendant would have had to do to submit? What would you?
Well, number one, he would stay there and not flee.
So the fleeing is important. So back to my question, if he had stood there for 2 minutes and then fled, you would say that's not submission.
Well, I guess you would look at other factors such as the interaction between the marshal and appellant. I know some courts look at whether there's conversation or whether identification is provided. But the fact is,
I'm not understanding the fleeing argument. The fleeing was a result of opportunity. So it just so happened that the cop turned away after a few seconds, might have turned away after 10 seconds, might have turned away after 2 minutes. What the fleeing shows here is when he got the opportunity to get away from the seizure, he took it. I don't know why it matters whether it's 5 minutes, 2 seconds, 5 seconds. The question is whether he was seized. It sure looks like a seizure when you look at related cases. When a police officer commands, as they commanded, firmly, put your hands up, and you put your hands up, most of us would think we've been seized. I don't think anyone in the room here would say, oh, no, it was no big deal.
Right, but the question is whether he actually submitted.
He did submit. He put his hands up.
Then if that's what the court
would. If he had run immediately, then you're talking in a language that I could understand. He didn't run a meter. He submitted.
But creating a rule where just because someone has this apparent gesture of compliance and all of a sudden they're insulated.
No, it was a real gesture.
A real gesture. He submits for 3 seconds, let's say. And then
I don't know why the time matters.
Okay.
The fleeing resulted because he had an opportunity to flee.
Right. And the fleeing was an intervening act. And then he voluntarily tossed these guns out. And it's not fruit of the poisonous tree. And creating a rule where a brief compliance then insulates the defendant would encourage deceptive tactics. It would put the public at great danger because now criminals know, okay, well, let me comply for a second, and then I'll flee.
You don't really believe that, do you?
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't think the word's going to go out.
This case is...
And, you know, hey, bro, don't, you know, fake it and then run?
I don't think so.
That's just not realistic. I realize there's stuff coming from the Supreme Court suggests there are going to be all kinds of weird, horrible things happening, but you're not coming through loud and clear on this one.
Well, this case is really indistinguishable from Hodari D., and if the court applies the but-for causality, there's no way the evidence from Hodari D. would have been admissible. Of course Hodari D. ditched the drugs, but for being chased, wouldn't have ditched his drugs, but for the show of authority in the pursuit by the police officer. And the Supreme Court rejects that but-for causality. And the test of taint is whether the evidence was recovered during the seizure or there's some lead recovered during the seizure. And the seizure was, as appellant admits, the seizure was over. And then he tossed the guns. And those guns, any possible taint is purged.
But did you skip over the Summers issue because you were convinced by Ms. Wright's argument that there was no search going on here? Summers.
Oh, Summers.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Let's go to Summers.
You weren't convinced of that, huh?
This case falls squarely within Summers.
Does it fall squarely within Bailey?
Yeah.
It does fall squarely within Bailey.
Why don't you just focus on exactly her argument, which is that Bailey says Summers applies only to people who are there when and where the search is going on. And here, there was no search going on.
And it also excludes the two hypotheticals that I've put to Ms. Wright, namely the question of the threat of the person coming back and attacking the officers making the search, and alternatively, his alerting Confederates about the search about to take place. Those seem to be pretty compelling arguments, but they're explicitly rejected in Bailey.
Well, Summers is a categorical rule, and so you don't need particularized suspicion. You need an occupant within the immediate vicinity. And in Summers and Bailey, both of these...
But immediate vicinity while the search is going on.
But they were securing the property. There's no requirement
Weren't they down the corner waiting for their colleagues to show up? And the only reason they drove around the corner was they saw this defendant coming down the street, right?
Right. They were securing...
The search wasn't going on, was it?
They were securing the premises, which the government thinks is an integral part of the search in order to assure officer safety and to protect evidence.
By seizing him, that was securing the premises? Is that your theory?
Yes. If you're securing a premises preparatory to the execution of a search warrant for a gun, for a homicide by gun, you're not letting people willy-nilly go in and out of the premises.
Is that what Officer Clark said?
Excuse me?
That's not what Officer Clark said. He said they weren't doing this. They said this guy came down the street all hinked up.
Right.
Right? He was all hinked up. That had nothing to do with the search. He just looked suspicious.
Well, it does have to do with the search.
But Clark never says that. You're saying that.
He was a departing occupant, and under Summers, the marshals were completely within their rights to exercise this exception and approach and identify him, and it was an eminently reasonable action. And let's not forget, they're not there doing some feckless surveillance exercise. This was a two-part story. First, Mr. Jerome Earls leaves this residence as they're preparing to execute the warrant. Marshall Clark had just come back from a car chase pursuing him, and it's reasonable to think maybe Earls alerted people in the house that, you know, the marshals were probably coming to search the house.
So suppose the car full of officers to do the search was a couple blocks away, nowhere near it. And this officer knew the search would happen in a while, and he made the arrest. Would that satisfy Bailey?
I don't think it would. And just to go back to the facts of this case.
Why wouldn't it?
Well, if your hypothetical is that he's a few blocks away?
No. Or, he's right where he is now, but the officers who are going to do the search are several blocks away. They haven't yet gotten there at all. In other words, they're not on the scene.
Well, then they couldn't be securing the premises preparatory.
Well, but this other officer was there, and he knew the search was going to happen in half an hour or so.
Well, is he securing the premises preparatory to the search, I think,
is
the question.
This is the first time I've heard that theory. I didn't hear it from Clark.
Clark specifically testified they were there to secure the premises, and they were merely waiting for the other marshals to return from chasing after Jerome Earls to execute the warrant. They had wanted to execute the warrant in the first instance when Mr. Earls left with somebody else. And so the search here was imminent, and Bailey and Summers both involved departing occupants, as we have here.
Okay. Do you have anything else?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Your time's up.
All right.
You can finish your sentence.
Thank you very much. And the court has no more questions. Okay. The government asks you remand for resentencing in light of DeCamp and respectfully request that you affirm appellant's conviction. Thank you.
Ms. Wright, do you have anything more you'd like to say?
I do.
I thought you might.
I wanted to address a few things. Quickly, one, I think the government said that Clark said that he was 5 feet away trying to make it seem like the Washington case, and I wanted to note that Officer Butler did say that they told him they were standing next to him on the sidewalk. On Hodari, I want to say a couple things, which is that we do need a bright-line rule, and the government, in Hodari, I think the government has to take Hodari the way it is, because pre-Hodari, the defense would argue you should decide if there's a seizure based on what the government does, not what the defendant does. And that was rejected, and the Supreme Court said, no, the defendant controls whether there's a seizure by whether he submits or not. And the government now wants to say, well, that's not good because that will lead to trickery. And I just, again, it's the bitter with the sweet. If the defendant's conduct controls, then it controls, and there has to be a bright-line rule. No amount of time should make a difference. The government, I thought, said submission is a factual finding, and I think we established in our brief that seizure is reviewed de novo. The government said that this was like Hodari in fruit with respect to the fruit issue, but in Hodari there was no illegality, so of course there could be no fruit of a poisonous tree. There was no poisonous tree. No seizure.
What do you think of her point that what was really going on here was they were beginning the process of securing the premises?
Yeah, I want to get to that because it's our position that you're either executing a warrant or you're not. You can't be securing the premises from down the block. That's not part of the execution of the warrant. That's surveillance in anticipation of the warrant, which could go on for any amount of time. And it's telling when the government says you can't willy-nilly let people go in and out. And if there's some dangerous situation and this is a homicide, of course, that's the Terry standard. And they say he was hanked up. Okay, if he'd been a little more hanked up or there had been other suspicious circumstances, it could have risen to the Terry standard. And that's what Justice Scalia points out. If you can't get into Summers, you have to meet Terry. It's not an onerous standard, but the government doesn't claim that this is justified under Terry. So that's the standard they needed to meet while they're waiting around the corner, just making sure nothing suspicious is going on. Nothing suspicious enough to meet the Terry standard did go on, and that's why Summers has to be met. If there's no further questions, I'd ask the court to suppress the evidence and remand for the sentencing.
Thank you both. The case is submitted.